There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Politics on the Couch, but I think you knew that already. I'm Raphael Baer, but you probably knew that already too. I'm not sure we even have to go through these formalities anymore, especially not with an episode like this. A rambling chat about all kinds of things that stretches to the very limit the podcast mandate we set ourselves to talk about the nexus of psychology and politics. There's plenty of both of those things in there somewhere in this conversation with my friend and former colleague Helen Lewis, but it's all bundled together with other chit-chats. High-end, serious, political and psychological chit-chat, of course. There's some stuff that was in the news just as we were recording a few weeks ago. Matt Hancock's WhatsApp messages. There's some culture war business. What Nicola Sturgeon misjudged over the Gender Recognition Act. That one will be back in the news soon enough. Immigration on small boats. That's in there. And that's rarely out of the news. There's a bit on digital contamination of politics. On anti-vaxxers. On Miami, which is Helen's latest obsession, and I commend to you her most recent piece in The Atlantic magazine about that particularly peculiar US state and its relationship with Republican presidential wannabe and all-round maniac Ron DeSantis. But first, being a pair of journalists who do a lot of podcasts, we talked about podcasts. Specifically, whether that field has become a bit crowded recently, especially with what might be described as blokish banter.
But I've been making this new Gurus episode about one about like why are so many Gurus men? And I put this theory to one of the podcasters, which is, do you think that women have friends and men have podcasts? And like, but what I mean is that they listen to podcasts that are like, if only I was in a pub with my friends, this is how fun it would be. And I can surrogately be there through listening to the podcast and all hooting with laughter at each other's stories.
Well, so there's a kind of, you get to have your cake and eat it in terms of being actually quite antisocial and spending time on your own in your man cave while also doing bants vicariously through other people's bants.
Yeah, listening to like Joe Rogan and Russell Brand like hooting with laughter at everything the other one says, but you don't actually have to leave your house. I mean, in some ways, amazing.
The podcast theory is I'm now rattling through the podcast that I listen to thinking, do I maybe do that a little bit? Like, so I really like, are we allowed to say the names of other podcasts on our podcast? I like The Rest is History. But I think their dynamic, it's quite a blokey dynamic. I mean, this is literally a blokey dynamic. It says it's too blokey.
It's so blokey. And then The Rest is Politics is like, how many of this essentially the same man talking to himself can we find? And like, there's just going to be endless iterations of it now, presumably. Like The Rest is Sport. The Rest is rowing. The Rest is
rowing is sport as well. That can't be a different podcast.
Well, like things that men like. What are men like? World War II. The Rest is dying early.
But what is? Yeah. What are there? There are women podcasts who.
No, they're not allowed. It's illegal, Raf. It's been outlawed for a couple of years now.
The rest is women.
The Rest is women. No, and there's fortunately with Fee and Jane, which does incredible numbers that they've now moved. But that's, which is basically like the lady version of The Rest is History, right? It's just two people having a chat and it's the same two people every week. Anyway.
I'm going to do a wild and probably wrong gender stereotype speculation here. And I wonder if this is because when women get together with their friends and talk about stuff, they genuinely perhaps share intimate things about themselves that are private. Whereas a lot of what men do in that situation is quite performative anyway, and they're not really letting anyone in. So it doesn't matter if you catch your microphone and broadcast it to, well, in our case, millions, but in some of these other podcasts, just a few thousand people.
Yes, I know what you mean. There's a sort of difference between, ha ha ha, mate, remember when I copped off with that girl in the Sainsbury's car park when I was 17, versus I'm really worried I don't love my children and my husband bores me. Like, oh, bit much.
Those are qualitatively different. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, no confessional. Is there a very confessional podcast form?
There is one about OnlyFans creators, which I have to say I've learned a thing or two from.
I don't know what that means. This now makes me feel like a bit like an old person who doesn't understand, who gets told off by his children for using his, like, prodding his phone with one finger instead of typing properly like a person under the age of 30. What have you just described?
So
what is
there's
that?
A big thing on TikTok of chopping up clips of podcasts. And so that's how I normally consume podcasts. Mm. And there's one that is made by OnlyFans creators. OnlyFans, the popular subscription site, which is, you know, allegedly for all kinds of stuff, but it's actually really for sex work. And it's two incredibly broad-minded women invite on other women whose job it is to be professionally broad-minded about the things that they're asked to do, and then they say things sometimes that make your hair curl.
Okay.
I highly recommend it to you.
Although it sounds like in this context the hair's probably already curly to the extent that it's on the podcast.
And then there's the one that's the you know, that one of the most popular ones is My Dad Wrote a Porno, which is two guys and a woman. And there's one
that was the origin story of podcasts catching on, wasn't it? That was the podcast, the first, for a lot of people, that was the first time they discovered podcasts.
Yeah, I haven't listened to any of that. And I was going to say, it feels like it's been so many years now that they're milking it, but I think that's not a happy phrase in the circumstances.
Anyway. I didn't even realise it was still going. I thought it was a one-off. I thought once the dad had written the porno, what more could they do? Did, like, make about another one? Presumably got better. I don't know.
He's now actually very good at it. They're not embarrassing at all. Anyway, sorry. We
My
should
dad
talk
is
about
now a professional
politics,
porn script writer. Yeah, let's talk. Right, no, but okay, so I'm now going to attempt an elegant segue into what it is we want to talk about. Right, so what we are talking about here is the phenomenon of media about media, and, you know, we're just demonstrating exactly how the sorts of people who engaged in that can do it forever, and actually at some point the iterations of that become really, really far removed from the actual culture that they're talking about. Two recent examples which I'll throw out there. One is the WhatsApp group, Matt Hancock and the WhatsApps, the sense that somehow there was this environment in which everyone was just sort of, no, this, that doesn't work, there's no connection there, is there?
No, I think there is a connection there, because it's about...
Okay, help me out with the connection here. I feel there's a connection, but I don't know what it is.
Because the thing I've got when I read those WhatsApp groups is that there is a complete blurring of the boundary between professional and personal. And that's something that you saw in journalism, first of all, with Twitter, right? So the same place that you were supposed to be breaking your stories and being like a serious news journalist was also people being like, I love cheese and, you know, I'm so depressed today, I don't think I can get out of bed. And you were like, you know, why are you telling 150,000 people who don't know you this? They don't care. And so the WhatsApps felt like that, right? You can't have a work environment in which there isn't some kind of lubricating banter. But the idea is that, like, if you're in a work environment, that would happen in the coffee break or whatever, or the beginning of the meeting, then you'd have the serious meeting. And what's the jarring thing about reading those WhatsApps is it's all just completely mixed. So it's half like, we are worried about the case fatality rates, are people going to die? And then it's half going like, George Osborne shading Matt Hancock for being overexcited, or like Michael Gove giving away that they're going to have a pointless meeting or whatever, you know?
Yes, no, exactly. So it's the sort of, well, first of all, I'm going to move on from the fact that you used the term lubrication and Matt Hancock in very close proximity in a sentence there.
Lubricating banter, Raph. That's what all podcasts run on.
Sorry. You're talking about, yeah, so it's the kind of the water coolerization of actually quite important things that go on. And I think you're right there that, I mean, that has always happened. And there has always been an understanding that there's an idiom that you use in private that you don't use in public. And actually, the assumption that some of those, or a lot of those conversations, ought to have essentially been, yeah, in real life meetings or memos, or, and there should have been a sort of civil servant noting that this was going on. And how different is that from sort of sofa government, which was a charge against the Blair administration long before this was a thing?
Yeah, it's a steady progression, isn't it? You know, the kind of Gove and the Mrs. Blurt email, if you remember that. There was the idea that they were using off the books Gmail and they were using GChat in order to get around freedom of information laws. So that was a problem of about, you know, 5-6 years ago. You're right about safer government. There's lots of stuff by Harold Wilson complaining about the fact that he was sitting there in cabinet meetings and Tony Benn was writing a diary. Barbara Carlson was writing a diary. I think Tony Crossan was writing a diary. It was basically like half the people were doing a cabinet meeting and half the people were writing like jaunty notes for future memoir use. So it's not new.
The Gove one where the message, which was presumably happening in the meeting, where someone said, why are we having this meeting? And Gove goes, so that these people can have a bit of therapy and feel better about having said something before we then afterwards just go and decide what to do. I mean, that, yeah, a lot of people have been in that meeting. That is not an unfamiliar experience. And what I find alarming about it, or where I think it's actually potentially important, is what we also know about the way that WhatsApp groups and those communications sort of radicalize and generate groupthink, that it might actually be doing something cognitive to the way people are thinking and discussing the issues that wouldn't happen if they were forced to do it in a slightly more rigorous professional setting.
Yeah, and I think actually being forced to say things out loud and to someone's face and have a synchronous conversation rather than an asynchronous conversation also changes your experience of stuff, right? I mean, I love WhatsApp. If I, you know, could marry an inanimate object, I would marry WhatsApp. But it makes you write in this very specific way that's almost like a sort of beat poetry, you know, because the rhythm of it is each individual line drops one at a time and you find yourself like adapting everything you're saying into that form. And it's very good for delivering a punchline because you can drop the like line, wait a second, then the beat comes in. And I just wonder if that does, you're probably right, it probably does actually fundamentally change the way that you think through and communicate in a way that's very different to the way that you would do. I mean, which is why everybody sort of talks about the fact that, you know, GIFs and emojis became so popular, because when you're having text-based speech, you're taking away all the phatic stuff that you get in communication. You have the tone of voice, the accent, the people's demeanour, the eye contact, all of that kind of stuff. And there's been an attempt to recreate that. But yeah, it is very odd that, in a way, there's probably some great academic study to be done about what it meant for decision-making, that decision-making was happening on WhatsApp in the first couple of months of the pandemic. Nothing good, I imagine, is the answer.
Well, yeah, well, no, but and just more generally, does a kind of casualization of quite important discussions, is it in any way related to unrigorous thinking and policy making? I mean, like, it's entirely possible that with Boris Johnson as prime minister, there wasn't going to be rigor anyway, and these people are just incompetent and charlatans and didn't know what they were doing. So the fact that they were expressing that via WhatsApp is that's really marginal to what the actual problem was. But in the same way, it sort of feels like when you wear a suit, you stand differently and you sort of consider yourself in a different position to when you're wearing your jeans and trainers. And I wonder if there's a sort of a linguistic thing where you're just, if there's a sort of a Bantz idiom to the way you're doing policy, actually the policy is worse.
You're right, though. It's very hard to separate it out from the particularity of the fact that the person that is involved in many of these WhatsApp groups is Boris Johnson. And I have to say, those leaks so far, the ones I've read, didn't particularly change my opinion of anybody, but it did remind me about his unique pathology, which is the total inability to bear sincerity. And so as soon as they start talking about case fatality rates, he has to be like, what does 0.04 mean? You know, answers on a postcard, like start of a 10, marks on... And he just can't sort of deal with being sincere. But, and this might be, you know, let's remember these are selectively released. We won't see them all. It's quite notable that Chris Whitty doesn't do that, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Well, and the formidable, that exchange where... The Spectator article where Johnson is sort of saying, why aren't we doing this thing that this writer in The Spectator thinks I should do? And the response,
people would die, Prime Minister.
Yes, that is a very effective piece of commentary written in the journalistic style. And then there's this other thing we call rigorous data, which would suggest perhaps a different course of action. But again, performing, communicating in that genre as you would expect a serious advisor to do had he also been in the room. Well, this isn't even the original thing I was going to ask you about. I'm completely sidetracked.
No, because I've been thinking about it because I'm doing a bonus. I'm thinking about doing a Radio 4 series about instant messaging, basically, and I'm really interested in that. You know, how much of our lives has moved into text, particularly, and like when that started, and we'll see. But I think the WhatsAppification of politics is just something that's really interesting to me because I think you're right. Like form does kind of, you know, dictate content to some extent.
Well, the lockdown really accelerated that, first of all, because everyone was, the WhatsApp group became the tea room for people who weren't allowed in Parliament. So, but also because closed WhatsApp groups are radicalizing and people perform and they like getting reward and they don't want to be the outrider, it did all sorts of crazy things. But then you have the sort of additional layer on top of that, which is if people know that a screenshot of it is going to be leaked, this sort of strange blurring of how much of this is a communication that has the simultaneously this illusion of great intimacy and is actually broadcast. And that goes back to, yeah, the main one of the genre, which is Twitter, and why it was so just caught on in politics and journalism so well.
Yeah, I think that's why. And I think there's been a move away from that stuff towards podcasts, in the sense, I think people genuinely do feel on a podcast you can't hide who you are.
I'm in trouble now then.
In the same way, right? Like everyone drops their guard after like 3.5 hours of rigorous podcasting. But you know what I mean? Like, and also because you just get people's tone of voice and stuff like that, that it's not quite so performative in the same way. Like when I first got on Twitter, it did have a sense of a space where you could actually genuinely have a conversation. And obviously for years, it has not in fact been that. It has been the press release service for the Department of Narcissism for all of us.
Yeah, or the anger video game, as someone brilliantly put it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So I agree with you. And I think that is interesting about those public-private Tory plotting WhatsApp groups, because clearly it's not stopping the Tory party plotting against people, right? They did a very good, effective job on Liz Truss in the end. But there is obviously the difference between the actual plotting WhatsApp group and the, you know, made-for-TV plotting WhatsApp group.
You observe this stream that you'd like to think, well, if I can still swim in that and not get wet, I'm not necessarily part of that problem. I can be in that, but not of it, which I think sort of self-evidently isn't true. And when you think about all the politicians who are still doing that and using it, there's a part of me that's perhaps almost too generous in thinking somehow they know that's not reality, that obviously they're maybe more cynical. Well, they're less cynical in a way than I think they are, that they might genuinely think, oh, likes and retweets, that means this is really popular, I should do more of that, as opposed to likes and retweets, this means the people who already massively agree with me and follow me on Twitter, and there's only about 30 of them, are giving me love. That's entirely meaningless as a representation of what's actually going on in the country. And I don't know which it is. Do you know what I mean?
No, I agree with you, because I think there's a way in which Twitter as well has been the largest vector of pluralistic ignorance. You know, the idea that nobody knows what actually everybody really thinks, because a couple of incredibly loud voices dominate and, you know, hector and bully people out. And then you find out that actually everybody has thought of something. And you know, some of the subjects I write about, gender being one of them, you get that sense very strongly, because literally everybody sends you private messages going, I completely agree with you. I couldn't say it out loud. And I think that has been one of the ways in which Twitter has been really poisonous for politics in a way that's not really often talked about. It was very notable that Biden, basically in his last election campaign, was like, I don't care about Twitter. It's completely pointless.
And I think actually at the top of the Labour Party, there is some awareness of that. Keir Starmer, I don't think, cares about Twitter, wisely. I mean, on the gender thing, I think it's quite interesting, you know, on the subjects of things on podcasts that can get into trouble. But no, it was...
No, you're fine. No one has ever been cancelled on a podcast, Raph. It's fine, test it out.
No, I mean, what struck me is how badly it seems misjudged the mood of where... I mean, she might have misjudged the mood of where progressive politics was, but where a lot of politics was generally, having previously had been a pretty solid reader of that sort of thing. I mean, she wasn't a great first minister in many ways, but she was a very effective politician. And yet the choice that she made there and the way she decided to amplify that into a constitutional battle on that particular issue, and the fact that the conservative, the English conservatives were able to say, nah, you're wrong about this. You've chosen the wrong battle here. And they were right and she was wrong. I wonder to what extent that was a bubble thing, that she just was surrounded by people who were surrounded by people who were actually in a smaller minority on that issue than they thought.
Oh, I think it was a bubble online and offline. I went to Scotland in 2021 to report on exactly this. And the headline of the piece, I think, ended up being the party whose success has become a problem. Because the thing that consistently came up was that, you know, in Scottish journalism and politics, as a sort of nexus, it's a very, very tight circle, to the extent that people are like, basically everyone here has had a drink with everyone else or slept with everyone else or worked with everyone else, right? Like the 6 degrees of Kevin McBacon would be like not even, you know, 3 degrees at most. And I think that was a problem. You know, she had stuffed the women's organisations and that sector with, you know, it, over the course of time, the way to get appointed into those more political facing lobbying jobs was to be somebody who the SNP could do business with. So she was in this kind of constructed hall of mirrors where everybody reflected her own opinion back to her. There was, you know, there wasn't, because the government hadn't changed for, you know, well over a decade, there was just everybody had kind of come through. Like, you can see a version of it now with the fact that, that businesses are desperately glomming onto Labour, hiring people who used to work in Labour, going, what does Labour think? Oh my God, we're going to have to deal with a Labour government. But I think that the SNP's incredible dominance shut them off from sources of information. And the thing about that's most troubling about it is that they had a dry run of the Gender Recognition Reform Bill in Humza Yousaf's hate crimes bill, which had some incredibly liberal provisions in it about, you know, sort of stirring up, you know, in your own home, the idea was you could be sort of done for hate speech. And exactly the same legislative process where it just didn't get enough scrutiny. It was obviously full of stuff that was going to either fall to legal challenges or if enacted and people start getting arrested for this stuff, incredibly unpopular. And it just didn't get through to them. And that was like a dress rehearsal for exactly everything that then happened with the Gender Recognition Reform Bill, where they just didn't listen to anybody who told them anything they didn't want to hear, basically.
I wonder, though, to what extent that's a function of what is essentially a small country run by a nationalist government. I mean, I remember when I was covering the Baltic states and in Latvian politics, Latvia is a small country. And because it was, its politics was founded on rehabilitation of nationhood from under the Soviet occupation, it was a nationalist project, you know, degrees of nationalism were all of its politics, largely. And everyone had been to the same universities, and the people who were in positions to get elite power all, as you say, knew each other, drank together, slept together. And with apologies to any Latvian politicians who might be tuning in now. And
I know what you mean, but it did make me, reporting that story did make me realise that actually the kind of push and pull of oppositional politics is really important. And the other under-considered thing about that was the fact that the SNP were governing with Greens. And the Greens in Scotland, for some reason, seemed much more vexed about gender reform than they did about, you know, the death of the panda or what, like old fossil fuels or anything like that. They had become a very, I mean, maybe segues us neatly to our main topic of conversations. I was really surprised that Green parties, to me, you know, should exist, right? There's a market demand for that. And yet the Green Party in Scotland seemed to be completely obsessed with culture wars, to being an ultra-progressive party that was out further on the left flank than the SNP, which was already a very progressive party. So, and I don't really understand why that happened, particularly apart from perhaps just Patrick Harvey's personality as the leader of the Scottish Greens.
Is one explanation possibly that The space for being a progressive force in Scottish politics is quite crowded because you've got the Labour Party and actually the SNP, yeah, well, it likes to have it both ways, but it pitches, you know, to at least its former Labour voters as a progressive party. But also then there's a wider long tail of what it means. So once you've decided, right, we're going to be left Puritans, we're the people who are left, but without, ugly compromises of actually having to, you know, manage an economy or make difficult governing decisions. Coupled with that, you are in this sort of the long tail of the post-Cold War era where you can say you're for socialism and you're against capitalism, but quite quickly, it's not entirely clear really what that means in practice. You know, it's all, yeah, there is this, I think it's a long-standing problem that radical left politics has with a economic story that will really get a purchase other than capitalism is mean and people don't get enough stuff as a result of it, or the distribution is unfair. And so, plus the people who feel this most passionately are often actually middle-class graduates. So it sort of defaults into a cultural space because it's not really about class emancipation through the means of production. It's not really about economic Marxism. I don't know, maybe that's overthinking it or just wrong, but it feels to me that there's a long tail of the left slightly vacating a hard economic argument to have a slightly easier cultural one.
Well, I often think a lot about that phrase, you know, that you're not stuck in traffic, you are traffic. And that's what I want to say to people who are like, the right keeps engaging in culture wars. And it's like, no, both sides are engaging in culture wars. You just think you're fighting for truth and justice and the other side are fighting the culture war, right? That's how it is. You have to understand that things that you are, principles you hold very dearly, are to them hysterical culture war propositions and vice versa.
The fact that woke the term has gone very efficiently from being a badge of honour that you can use to describe yourself if you're enlightened about race politics to something that the right accused the left of being to wind them up, and it's a term of abuse, and then that the left and the progressive left more or less denies even exists. But it happened incredibly quickly. But the same thing happened with political correctness. You know, it wasn't, I don't think there were people advertising themselves as politically correct, but there was clearly a notion that there was a right and a wrong way to express yourself, and that it was better to be, there was no better way of saying it. You have to be correct in your politics, and that was political correctness. But as soon as only existed within the formula of something that had gone mad, according to Daily Mail columnists, the left and the progressive side immediately relinquished it and said, well, they don't even recognise this term. This isn't a real thing. And we're not going to therefore try and define what the doctrine is, because the doctrine only exists in the minds of paranoiac right-wing people who are trying to get us. But then you don't ever have a doctrinal kind of codex of things you actually believe that people can legitimately attack, because you just say it doesn't exist. It's just something in the, it's a figment. Did that make any sense at all, what I just said?
It does. And I did warn you I was going to bring this back to Florida, because I've spent the last 6 months thinking about Florida. But if you apply that, you know, thesis from The Coddling of the American Mind that Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff book about, you know, the kind of sorting of American jobs, right? So the police have become more right-wing and academics have become more left-wing. Then you begin to understand why that might have happened, right? Because neither side, both sides feel like they're the underdog. So the left has had a pretty rubbish time in electoral politics across large bits of the West in the last 20 years. So it doesn't feel like it's had a crack in, you know, in Britain, I think is that's definitely true. But at the same time, the right feels that it's completely excluded from the citadels of culture, from museum boards and university professors, you know, and publishing and, you know, like all the kind of cultural institutions. So that's where that divide, I think, both sides would say that the other one is, you know, dictating and holding forth and has got the reins of power. It's just, you know, it's kind of an impossible thing to resolve, I guess.
I mean, yeah, so there is a plausible argument that over the arc of the baby boom generation, the left won the culture war. In so just thinking about the US context, where by the mid-80s, it was completely accepted that the Vietnam War, which I think was really the key schism in American politics that really defined so much of what then became culture wars. It was the sort of the platoon Full Metal Jacket version of what the Vietnam War was, as in an appalling, terrible waste of human life that just traumatized that generation and came absolute orthodoxy. You had such liberal attitudes about sex, sexuality, drugs became kind of just what was cool as advertised by liberal culture in Hollywood and increasingly popular entertainment. So you could see if you're basically a socially conservative person in sort of late era Reagan's America and then under Clinton, I get that although you'd completely won the economic argument by the end of Reagan, you know, you couldn't understand why your appeared to be your mainstream culture sort of hated you and thought you were a nasty reaction. You were always the bad guy.
And the turbocharged version of that is now exemplified by something like the Libs of TikTok account on Twitter, right? Which exists only to find the most extreme content by people with neo-pronouns and whatever it might be, you know, trying to tell three-year-olds to love drag and then reposting it for conservatives to get mad at. So that's the other thing that turbocharges the culture wars, is just a huge amount of access to the most extreme end of the other side, which is also the phenomenon of, like, back when she was on Twitter, the kind of quote tweet of Katie Hopkins to show that you're against Katie Hopkins, right? That it was just like constantly these social media platforms just rewarded you for finding a member of the opposing tribe who was unbearable and saying, look at this unbearable person. I just think, I wonder again if those social conservatives that you're talking about, you know, they might have lived, particularly in America, but I think also here, like, you might have just lived in a place where that you were more felt that was a homogenous place. And then once the internet opens up, you suddenly see that other people are living these very different lives.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Liliana Mason, who's a very good American psychologist writing about polarization, who makes this point with regard to the sorting thing, that actually it wasn't that long ago that you had Democrats who felt very strongly about gun control, Democrats who were actually evangelical Christian, and you know, Republicans who believed in right to abortion. That definitely existed, actually, not all that long ago. And this is separate to digital sorting, that just actually literally people moving towns and, you know, going to college and then staying with their college groups and getting jobs in certain ways polarized that. And then on top of that, you add the digital silos. But that then leads to this phenomenon where, and again, it's a thing, it's a point that, I don't know if you've read Ian Leslie's book, Conflicted, about, like, he makes quite a good point in that, which is it's not true that people on the internet are only exposed to the points of view they agree with. They actually get exposed to many more points of view they don't agree with than if they were just reading their favorite newspaper or, you know, whatever, watching their favorite TV channel. The problem is their exposure to those things is presented to them by someone they trust as an exemplar of stupidity and wrongness. Like, behold this point of view that surely you can agree is completely insane and wrong and morally an affront to all that's decent. So that is, yeah, it's a subtle distinction, but I think it's important that exactly you say the sort of, and what happens then, sorry, I'll stop whittering in a second, but is you get the...
No, I just, it's interesting when you said that, because it just made me think about the incredibly interesting Dominion lawsuit against Fox Yes. News that's happening in the US. So Dominion makers of the voting machines are suing Fox News. Fox News repeatedly implied that there was a kind of conspiracy, and it's very hard to sue for, you know, libel and things like that in America. You have to essentially prove actual malice. And so there's been this huge release of text messages from behind the scenes from some of the biggest Fox names around the time of the election, that's basically... You know, it's going to help them make the case of actual malice, because it is full of personalities saying this will be terrible for our ratings if we say that Donald Trump hasn't won. And like Tucker Carlson saying Donald Trump, quotes, disgusts me. It just really reminded me when you said that, because the other thing is metrics, right? And just, and obviously on TV, you can instantly see the audience feedback. But also if you're any kind of YouTube creator or tweeter or whatever it is, you just have so much more exposure to what people like and don't like. You know, when you were writing for an old-fashioned print newspaper, there maybe was an overwhelming letter-writing campaign about something, but otherwise you sort of hurled stuff into the void.
I know, I find it amazing looking back to think that, you know, I started out in that game, and I find it odd to think, wow, all that stuff. When I was writing those columns for the New Statesman back in the day, I mean, occasionally I'd get an email from someone saying I like that, or occasionally get a call from Ed Miliband's office saying, what have we done to upset you so much? But by and large, I just had to presume it was okay. You know, it was basically, you know, the editor and sometimes you would give me some feedback. Do you know what I mean? And it's that's interesting. But also...
But that's why, again, like podcast is a return, right? Because actually what you do is you hear individually from podcast listeners, whether they like things or not. They don't tend to like gang up and on you and sort of like mass on you with flaming pitchforks. It's a return to a much older... sort of like one-to-many relationship rather than the many all getting together amongst themselves and kind of deciding what a twat you are.
That is interesting. And again, but also incredibly intimate in the sense that, you know, as you say, that once you start chatting and the boundaries start to dissolve a bit and you're speaking directly into someone's ear. Hello, people. I'm speaking directly into your ear. You know, that's actually a bit weird when you think about it. Let's not overthink that.
I know what you mean, though. But also, and the little details of your life creep in, right? Like, so Stephen Bush and I had a podcast for several years at the New Statesman, which you were on sometimes. But, you know, the fact that his weird tabletop gaming habits or like whatever would just kind of creep in quite naturally, or like my bizarre love of the theatre. And people then do end up, like there are running jokes and stuff like that. And you're right, it becomes intimate again in a way that writing for the internet really isn't. Because actually, there was a big move towards like the school of the incredibly aggressive personal essay. And then now, almost every writer I know now feels much more tense about putting anything because it hangs around forever for people to use it as sort of opposition research.
Well, exactly. That's a very interesting point, the sense of your basically how what you write, what you put in print and put on the internet is sort of ammunition for your enemies. And that as a...
Yeah, and I wonder if politicians feel differently as well, because speeches are now searchable, right? If you wanted to find out something someone racist had said in 1982, you had to go and find their campaign leaflet that had been put through people's doors. And 10 years later, it'd be quite difficult to find that. And now it's just all there. Like, sometimes it's very, you know, not easily accessible by Google, but like, I wonder if that's changed the way that people think and sort of hedge in the way that they think, or they try and couch stuff much more in boilerplate.
I was having a conversation with someone just today about this. I'm thinking about the mid-90s, Tony Blair's rise to power, the Peter Mandelson operation from Milbank, and the awesome message discipline that they had, which is sort of held up as this model of how to win, or how to run up at government and win. But you think, what, with four TV channels, a few newspapers, the people are easy.
Yeah, I know. The first piece of advice is first, go back to 1994. Next.
So, these things. I mean, on that, the point about hedging, though, makes me think there's, back to this question of opinions that actually you get exposed to only in the context of where the benchmark for what's wrong is, as a sort of a moral sorting tool. I think the other thing that happens is you end up being afraid to agree with any of what the enemy tribe actually thinks. And this is definitely what's contributed to the polarization on the gender and trans question, because I think this is, again, something that I'm sure Nicola Sturgeon and a lot of people on the left got wrong about this, is they just thought, because the people who are sitting there thinking, don't really understand this, it's a bit complicated, don't really see any problem with trans people being trans people, that all makes perfect sense. The sport thing, yeah, I can see there's a bit of an issue there. Prisons, refugees, yeah, that looks a bit complicated. What exactly has everyone got against J.K. Rowling? Haven't really followed it, but looks a bit mad. You know, that is that general kind of, can't we all just sort of work through this without shouting at each other? Which was so, when you think about it, so obviously going to be the broadest segment of reasonable people, simply wasn't expressing itself at all for years and years in that debate. Because they just didn't want to say something that would make them agree with people they hate, you know.
No, it's giving succor to the enemy. Like, that is, and that's why I find Keir Starmer's strategy on it to be completely fascinating, because I think he's throwing a huge smothering blanket of boredom over it. And my hunch about it is that he will say, like, there's still a commitment to, quote unquote, reform the Gender Recognition Act, right? But you know, you could reform it in any number of ways that don't involve putting rapists in women's prisons. So I just think my hunch about the way that he operates is that he's just never going to say anything that indicates that he's even slightly gender critical, but he's not going to enact obviously bonkers reforms that would alienate even huge numbers of Labour voters, right, who are much likely to be younger and therefore much more likely to sort of self-describe as being pro-trans rights.
Because there's a way of articulating it, you need to get the formula right in a way that could pass the sort of shibboleth test for some of those people, I suspect.
Yeah, I think so.
So he'd better rather than just not say anything.
I think so. And I think you can see them. It's really been interesting to watch the evolution of the message discipline and who's been allowed to get away with what. I mean, there's obviously, one of my main problems with that argument is it's incredibly sexist, and that the same statement coming out of a woman's mouth versus a man's mouth, or like a feminist mouth versus a random man's mouth, is just treated completely differently. But you will now have Wes Streeting, his Shadow Health, just say, like, a woman's got a vagina, a woman's an adult human female. Which, you know, having lived through this, was considered to be an unspeakably spicy take 3 years ago. But it's kind of like...
And is that different because he's basically a man, or because actually somehow the middle area where people think, well, you have to at least be able to say some things about this for it to even be a debate at all, has surfaced above the water level?
I think being a man definitely helps. But I also think it's about the fact that he's never publicly aligned himself with gender critical feminist side, which then purchases him the ability to say things. You know, my big thing I'm kind of constantly obsessed with is the fact that you should always try and use the like language and concepts of your political opponents, right? So there's a big argument going on in America. And one of the things that I think Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, has been very good about doing is to say, like, freedom. California is freedom. Freedom, freedom, freedom. Which is obviously a huge tactical knock at DeSantis and Florida saying, you know, their idea of freedom. But if you're on the left, you should say, like, you have the freedom here not to die of a preventable disease. You have the freedom, like, not to worry that you're going to, you know, become bankrupt if you lose your job. But present it in the terms that your opponents, like, you know, that would understand. And I think that's something that I suspect is happening with the gender argument in the top bits of the Labour Party is to never sort of, you know, never align themselves with a side, but use phraseology that is acceptable to that side, if you see what I mean.
The sort of the alternative be, or the alternative problem is if you use the a sort of a jargon, not necessarily with regard to the particular the gender argument, but more generally sort of cultural arguments. If the left is always talking about social justice and equality, then even before they've started to articulate the argument, the segment of the audience goes, well, whatever you're about to tell me, you, that's what I would expect you to think anyway, because you're a sort of mad lefty or whatever. Whereas if you talk about, I mean, freedom is a very specific American thing, but in the UK, it would be, I don't know, opportunity, security, aspiration. But the thing is, you then have this problem with your own side that people say, just by using those terms, you've been captured. You see that. Yeah. You know, so the classic one being immigration, you know, that it's quite hard to know what a Labour position on small boats would be, that to articulate it at all, that wouldn't at a certain point on the left be considered a sellout, and you've essentially adopted the language of the enemy.
Right. And poor old Ed Miliband could tell you all about that with his controls on immigration mug. But like, what Labour Party in history has not imposed any controls on immigration? Obviously, some kind of controls on immigration are going to be part of any nation state in the 21st century's approach to its borders. So yeah, I know what you mean. And there is also a fundamental problem as well, which comes down to, this is where we're the problem, and I mean we as commentators, about lazy commentators who only look at the rhetoric and don't look at the actual policy. And you know, you can look at something like, I was just going to say, like Labour's Israel policy, right? Where is it versus what is the language that they're using about it? You know, that's the kind of thing, is that you end up with all these people who've only looked into it very slightly going on sort of vibes. And that kind of comes to a bigger point about why the culture wars persist, which is that they're very easy when you're on deadline to turn in 1,000 words on, aren't they? Let's be honest.
Well, to have a view, yeah. Well, there are...
Right. I know you don't succumb to this because you're, you know, you're doing proper journalism, but I do read a lot of columns where I'm like, well, that was... You were the day before and you were like, crisis, really nothing going on. Or like, I can't do Brexit again. I'll tell you what, I'll do statues. Or, you know, why aren't you...
But you know, but okay. But you get into a... Like, so small boats is interesting though, because it's hard to disentangle. Clearly, that's not statues. That, first of all, so having... To what extent you have an asylum policy that works is important. To what extent people really do feel very strongly about this, and they have MPs and they channel their strong feelings to their MPs, and they're entitled to be represented in Parliament with those strong views, even if we don't like them very much. That's also democracy. But also, it is, to me, sort of plainly the case that the Conservative Party and Suella Braverman have locked onto this issue in the most cynical, vindictive way, with no intention at all of delivering a policy that would actually work, or at least certainly no understanding of how it would work. And so therefore, yeah, where I suddenly have a lot of sympathy with people on the left who just say, I no longer care about what would be politically effective for Keir Starmer to do, or how he has to reach the red wall. I actually just want a leader who's going to stand up and go, fucking stop it. Stop the vilifying of refugees. Just like, and that's why I think the weird Gary Lineker thing, which drives me mad. I think everyone stopped talking about Gary Lineker. I think there is an element where he filled a void where maybe actually the leader of the opposition should have just been saying some things that were morally true about what the government is doing.
Yes, I think there is. And that is one of my big questions about Keir Starmer. It's like, oh, it's so clever to stay out of these arguments. And it's like, but how many arguments do you stay out of without making me think, well, why didn't I just vote for the Tories instead? And that's the problem, isn't it? It looks super smart to never get, you know, walloped in on the Daily Mail front page. But at some point, the job of the leader of the opposition is to get walloped on the Daily Mail front page and just, you know, sack up, son. And like, obviously, pick your issues. But the small boat thing I find really fascinating. I first wrote about it in 2020. Do you remember during lockdown, Nigel Farage decided that he was a journalist and therefore didn't have to obey lockdown because he was going to do some important reporting on the small boats? And he went down to Kent and got on a sort of like dinghy and then, oh, look, his boat. And I remember thinking, oh, that's brilliant. Like, he's obviously just doing a kind of sampling tour of like, what are the new issues that I could glom onto? And I think actually, to some extent, he's decided to go for kind of lockdown regret. You know, this feeling that there's that bit of the populist right is now trying to turn lockdowns into kind of the Versailles Treaty that is the kind of great grievance that can be prosecuted forever. I'm just not sure it... I think it works for a small segment of the audience, and maybe that's enough to make those people feel, like, relevant and flush with cash. I'm just not sure the vast majority of Britons want to prosecute the argument about what was and wasn't done right during COVID. I think that most of us are just very happy not to be locked in our houses anymore. But the small boats thing I find weird, because it made sense for Nigel Farage as an extra parliamentary right winger to say, this is a terrible problem. Why won't the government do this? Look, there's compelling footage of it, blah, blah, blah. When you're the Tory Home Secretary, why are you raising the salience of an issue which you cannot control, particularly when you cannot control without the cooperation of the French, who you are spending all your time having therapeutic sort of slanging matches about to show how, you know, big and manly you are post-Brexit. That's the bit I don't understand. Like, what is the focus group that they're seeing that makes them think this is good politically? Never mind, as you say, morally it being unjustifiable.
It would appear to me that the obvious risk here is that you ramp up the salience of the thing. You confirm to the people who care most about it that this is genuinely the thing you should feel very passionately about, and this really is the outrage that you believe it to be. And in time, you advertise your impotence and inability to deal with it, at which point either the voters you were hoping to win over go off to whatever the next iteration of Farageism is, or they stay home. And actually, that's a Labour seat. Because all you only need 2,000 people in, or 3,000 people in some of those constituencies to not vote Tory. You don't need anyone to go over to Labour, and Labour have won the seat. So, and because that seems to me so obvious in a way, a hazard, I think, you know, I've asked around, and there seem to be two explanations for this. And the first one is it's literally the only thing that might work. So it's come down to...
Great. That's what you want to hear when, like, the record NHS waiting lists and, like, yeah, well, sod it. We can't do anything about that stuff. We're completely screwed.
If you can somehow, like, it's a very narrow path, but if you can just sort of say to enough people who care about immigration culture, broadly the sort of right-wing culture voters, I'm on your side, and hold on to enough of them, and then separately just do... you know, managerial competence on the economy, inflation's come down just like we said it would, and somehow that was our doing as opposed to it just happening by itself, and then stir up some kind of fear of Keir Starmer, you've maybe get to the point where at least you deny him a majority. That's literally that. So you don't like it, but that's literally the only available strategy there is. The other explanation is that Rishi Sunak genuinely doesn't understand the lesson of the last 15, 20 years of conservative politics, which is the lesson of David Cameron, you know, i.e. if you feed the right-wing beast, it's never satisfied. It always comes back for more. And the reason he would maybe not understand that is because to have an understanding of it at all, to even appreciate what a terrible, terrible mistake it was for David Cameron to do the net migration target, to give UKIP everything they wanted on Europe, you'd have to be in a kind of cognitive space which recognises that Brexit was a mistake.
He certainly is not going to say it out loud. Yes, I think that's true. And I also think there is a problem about the small boats in the sense of trying to make it a problem about France and all the French navies escorting them to British waters. Like, that kind of jingoism is also a big part of it. But you've lost the amazing chip that you always had as a Conservative all the way through the 2010s, which was like, and if, of course, if we had Brexit, we wouldn't have to deal with any of this. Like, the kind of... the grievance aspect of it is more complicated now that technically we are supposed to be sovereign and free. There is also a third secret option, which is just that Suella Braverman really seriously does believe this. She is the most hawkish person on immigration in the whole world. I seem to remember meeting her at Question Time in like 2016, 17. And I think her husband genuinely was a very rare British Donald Trump supporter. So it may be simply that she is the most right-wing person who has ever lived. And she's just entirely... carved this policy out on her own.
Well, and also, if she wants to be a leader or do well in leadership contests, you know, she knows who her sort of selectorate is. I mean, I met Suella Braverman before she was Suella Braverman.
Suella Fernandez, yeah.
and at a conservative, this is, I'm definitely gambling on thing that like your theory that no one listens to actually podcasts or no one's got this far yet. So anyway, yeah. I'll just tell this story just between you, me, this microphone, and anyone who happens to be listening to this podcast. And frankly, I'm never, it doesn't really matter because Suella Braverman's never going to like me anyway. I remember chairing an event.
There goes the chance to ghostwrite her autobiography, Raf, which I know you've been hanging on for.
Well, yeah, but at least she could trust me with her WhatsApp messages. Right, anyway, I'm going to tell the story. It's not an interesting story. I've already overhyped it up. I was chairing an event with her at a Conservative Party conference. I think she might even have still been a prospective parliamentary candidate before she was even an MP. And the ECHR thing came up, as it often does at Conservative Party conferences, and she was talking absolute bilge about the, you know, Human Rights Court, you know, conflating it with the European Commission, with the European Council, with the European Union, just all the things that you just, I was sitting there chair thinking, wow, yeah, you really have no idea what you're talking about. And then I remember thinking, are you actually incredibly stupid, or are you already quite adept at pretending to be incredibly stupid because you think that's a sensible thing to do? And I remember checking her out afterwards and thinking, well, you've got a good degree from Cambridge. And it comes back to this thing, and this is, I think, interesting in relation to the Dominion voting thing and Fox, because it really sort of answers a question for me, that stuff, which is, I had thought, those people at Fox, how much do they actually believe this? And how much of it is just incredibly cynical? They know exactly how, what's going on. They just, it's raw interest in power and venality and amorality. And how much is actual ideology? And the answer is a lot, right? They don't believe this shit, really. They are actual bastards.
I know. And in a weird way, it really cheered me up, because I was like, oh, this is really morally simple. They do just hate their own audience, and they are cynically milking them for ratings and, you know, selling them weird pillows from the MyPillow guy. Oh, that's quite relieving in a way. But it also kind of explains why they're so angry when anyone questions them, right? Because it is that classic psychological thing of, you know, actually you're in the wrong. And then when anyone points it out to you, become much more furious as a way of kind of having to deal with projecting that feeling of, you know, back outwards again. So it made total sense to me. But yeah, I know what you mean. There is a kind of sense of, like, there are quite a few people in British politics who do appear to sort of voluntarily lobotomize themselves in the pursuit of power. And I wonder if she falls into that category, or if she's just learnt a set of sort of talking points. Because that's the other thing you meet sometimes when you meet politicians, right? It's like, obviously they all get the lines to take, and some people bother to read stuff from first principles, and some people are very, they know they can wing it. And actually the more eloquent people really, you know, they cause themselves trouble because they always can wing it. And so maybe she's just really good at winging it and just reading the lines to take, and she's become a sort of living line to take.
But that would suggest, I mean, so is it possible then that at some level, this is really reaching here, at some level the sort of the anger with Gary Lineker about tweeting saying, this is all a bit of Third Reich, isn't it? Your migration policy isn't just them saying, oh, brilliant, we can have an argument with the lefty BBC. This is just what we love doing. Like, as you know, you were saying about columnists, you know, this is just so much easier than having policy. Let's have this fight forever. And how, or is there an element of somewhere deep down in the shriveled, hardened kernel of their soul, there is still just a moist droplet of conscience that makes him think, no, he's kind of got a point about this being actually really nasty and racist. I don't actually believe that. I honestly don't, but I kind of want to.
No, because I feel like one of the things that I think is genuinely cheers me up about heading very fast towards 40 is I now feel like I have been around long enough in covering politics to have seen the same thing happen two different people, like the same scenario play out. And there is a thing where you just become the highest paid person at the BBC, and then everybody wants to have a go at you. It happened to Jonathan Ross, right? And yes, okay, so he and Russell Brand should not have phoned up Manuel from Fawlty Towers and bragged about sleeping with his granddaughter. That was gauche. But like, that was the thing that was kind of waiting to happen. Then it happened to Clarkson. And yes, he should not have decked that producer at the end of a long day's filming. But like, it is the kind of drumbeat of the highest paid BBC presenter, and it becomes like, get him, and it is usually a bloke, get him, let's find the thing, because the scalp is just too good, and they become the avatar of BBC excess in whatever way, right? Highly paid BBC presenter. So I think you know, Gary Lineker has just been the axe has been waiting to fall on him. I wonder, I mean, he makes a lot of money, obviously, but not that everything in this world comes back to podcasts, but he does own Goalhanger, right? Like, he does own a podcast company, which must be making a fairly decent wedge.
Yeah, they're doing well. They're literally selling out stadiums, putting two blokes in front of a microphone, and they are blokes, talking about politics, yeah.
Talking about the Russian Revolution. Yeah, but that's the same, which is the same thing, right? And Clarkson went to Amazon for squillions, and Jonathan Ross went to ITV for a really decent. Like, the people who get to be the most best paid BBC producer tend to do it because they're quite good at presenting and in quite high demand. So I don't know. There is a kind of just feeling like, and I think if Gary Lineker falls and he just decides to sod off, you know, bad luck, Graham Norton. Like, your time is coming now.
Next.
Yeah, but that's one of the reasons why BBC presenters now try and get paid through production companies, because it hides their salary. Because the last thing you want to do is be the face of BBC salaries.
On this particular issue, though, you do feel that it's the week when they've done the bill, and it's the message the government most wants to talk about. I mean, it just feels so, you know, Pompidou Centre wearing all the structure on the outside. It's not even trying to have a policy that would feasibly stop the boats, which is the name of the policy. It's clear, very clear.
But that is quite American. That's quite American. So there's a thing that's happening now. That there's a special legislative section in Florida. I know you always wanted me to tell you about the
Yeah, that's going to be the title of this podcast episode is going to be Florida. It's there in the background.
It's always lurking, the America of America, as they call it. But so they're having a special legislative session. There's essentially a cleanup session now that Ron DeSantis and the Republicans have a supermajority in the House and Senate there, so they can pass anything that they like. And some of the things that they are putting through are obviously unconstitutional. And it's because what they want to do is they want to have the fight, and they want to be, they want the judiciary, like, ooh, these corrupt judges, which is, again, like a very Orban tactic as well, right? You identify some people who can be painted as enemies who are holding you back, and then you deliberately pick fights with them. And that, to me, seems to be a, maybe that always happened in British politics, but I can't remember seeing that it happened so obviously before, where I guess it happened over Brexit, right? The whole thing was like, we're going to pick lots and lots of fights about stuff we can't do because the evil Europeans are holding us back. And you talk to other people who are ministers, and they were like, there was very little that I wanted to do that Europe wouldn't let me do because I didn't want to do crazy, bonkers, insane things. Like, how big a problem was that actually? And it was quite a big problem if you were Steve Hilton and you wanted to replace the Department of Work and Pensions with a website and make everybody have flammable sofas that were going to kill their children. But if you were doing things within a sort of moderate scope of British politics, it wasn't actually this huge imposition on you. But trying to do deliberately impossible things so that you can blame it on someone else when you can't do them is a very now established kind of culture war tactic, actually.
Well, certainly in this case, there's obviously, I think, an element of that, because why won't it work? Well, for many reasons, but one of them is there will be legal challenges. And so what you've set up is the obstruction to stopping the boats is
lefty human rights lawyers. Do you know who's a lefty human rights lawyer? Oh, it's Keir Starmer. Come on down. Yeah, I think that strikes to me to be a way that it comes back to your point about cynicism, quite grimly cynical, like the Rwanda flights. Like, how many people are even now living their, you know, best lives in Kigali? No, it was there to be deliberately horrible and punitive and fought against.
But then why isn't there an available, this is something we've come back to, you keep cycling around this issue on the podcast, and we never really get an answer to it. Like, you feel intuitively the right centre-left leader ought to be able to call that out effectively, and that not be, haha, you've just walked into my trap as the liberal lefty human rights lawyer. There must be a way of asserting the moral principle that you would expect a liberal left human rights lawyer to believe in a way that actually speaks to the humanity of lots of people and is not blundering directly into an evil trap set by a mad Australian reactionary advisor in Downing Street.
Yeah, I think you're right. You have to be an incredibly charismatic and eloquent left-wing leader to do that, I guess, really compelling. And I would say we had a run of people who were not quite so much that. But I think the fact is, I mean, I'm stealing this point from Stephen Bush, who used to make it all the time, which was that with a predominantly right-leaning press and a BBC which still very often doesn't break stories, that it follows stories, then you end up with 10 minutes on the Today programme about Gary Lineker and not actually interrogating the policy because the agenda has been set elsewhere.
And also, particularly with the BBC that is so easily terrified of being perceived to have a liberal bias, because so many people who I said used to work there, I mean, the upper echelons, it's changed a bit, but yeah, that sense that the BBC will over-report and will lean so hard into... Yeah,
because it's staffed by Remain voting graduates who live in London and the South East. So it knows it's got an open wound there to be kind of someone can jam their finger into. Yeah, definitely.
It takes an element of courage to say, we're not going to recover this story because you're just talking nonsense. The real issue here is, will this law or will it not stop the boats? That would be a nice thing for the BBC to dedicate some of its, you know, to lead the 10, as opposed to Gary Lineker tweeted that he wasn't going to resign or whatever it was that led the 10 o'clock news recently. I almost said last night, but by the time you're listening to this podcast, that might be anywhere between last week and in the past, when small boats were still an issue.
at some point. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think your point is really key, though. Like, having seen them co-opt this issue from Farage is, I think someone thinks that's really clever and I think that's really dumb. I think you're right. You are always setting yourself up to be outbid by somebody who doesn't have any guardrails of what they can and can't say. And doesn't have any, you know, no one is expecting them to deliver on any of it either. I don't know. Like, why would you get into an auction with Farage about who can be meanest about immigrants? It's just, you're not going to win that contest, are you?
I mean, and actually that point about deploying legislation purely as a way to demonstrate that the sort of liberal establishment is sick and broken as an American device. Actually, that gets us on something that I wanted to talk about at the beginning. We now don't even have time to talk about, which is whether it's possible. Maybe just like... Five minutes.
Go on, we'll do it in one sentence. Yeah.
Whether it's possible that the Conservative Party right now is suffering a little bit from the obsession with US politics and thinks that there is this fantastically lucrative seam of anti-woke, radical, right-wing, slightly Trumpian politics to mine, forgetting that actually Britain is a European country and we're not so into that shit as much as the Americans are. It'd be like having, like, with Kemi Badenoch suddenly start talking about gun control. It's like, no, because that's their weird problem. That's not our problem.
I know. It's the one thing that's been really, you know, when I've been writing this piece, my editors have been like, you can just don't be sort of, you know, like, we know it's weird that that we have all these assault rifles, but like, don't go on about it. And I'm like, but literally, like, I watched Gogglebox, and they were, a couple of weeks ago, they had like some mad story from America about some 7-year-old who's a gun influencer on YouTube. And, you know, obviously Gogglebox is so constructed as to have representation, like a kind of amazing focus group, right, from every age group, ethnic minority, like demographic, all over. But every single person on Gogglebox was like, that's obviously insane. Why would you give a 7-year-old a pistol? And that sort of stuff, I think, there is just great reaches of American politics that are just inaccessible to us because we just don't have the cultural background for them. Like, that, lots of things have been normalized in American politics that are just still completely alien here. But yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I think there's also a problem about the kind of YouTuber influencer economy. I've been thinking quite a lot about Isabel Oakeshott, as one does, and the fact that, you know, that there is an enormous amount of money to be made by anti-vax stuff, by ivermectin as a COVID treatment, by lockdown skepticism, relitigating that kind of stuff. Weren't we right all along? By lab leak as a theory, you know, as a conspiracy theory.
So that comes back to this question of cynicism versus stupidity versus ideology, that actually, yeah, it might be just perfectly rational to think there's an awful lot of people out there. There's a wide zone where a kind of a general crystals and wellness and new age stuff blurs into conspiracy theory madness, and as often anti-vax is the bridge between those
crunchy,
two things.
Yeah, wellness.
So just a commercial choice to go and be a nutter.
But also, if they were doing stuff that I agreed with, then you would frame that as giving a voice to the voiceless, people who are excluded ruthlessly from the mainstream establishment in the Overton window, right? It just so happens that I think it's all bonkers. So I think it's a cynical grift rather than being a very moving attempt to, you know, bring some of these alternative perspectives to the mainstream.
I think we're allowed to draw a distinction between political positions that are marginal and things that are literally just not true, like, you know, that are actual flat lies.
Get you. Very old-fashioned.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, yeah, so
It's not always that clear cut, though, right? Like, some of the anti-lockdown arguments are about things like the effect on mental health of children and stuff like that. You know, that they are kind of reasonable and maybe harder to quantify than excess deaths from COVID. Like, how do you stack up actual deaths versus sort of misery and long-term consequences or consequences on the NHS waiting list or cancer and stuff like that? So I think there's a problem now, but it kind of comes to that kind of giving succor to the enemy, right? That it now, the danger is that that becomes so polarized that we never have a proper conversation about what a good, what like what the limits of a next time of a lockdown policy should be. What's an acceptable level of trade-offs between the two? But my hope is that the COVID inquiry deals with that in a kind of normal, measured way, so it doesn't have to be settled by like opinion columnists duking it out, which would be bad.
Exactly that point, that you don't want to... You judge whether or not you hold or express an opinion based on, you know, who the worst possible person who might also hold that opinion is. And that's very limiting. So, you know, if you, that's, you know, or on the lockdown thing, yes, you know, it should be possible to say, look, well, actually, you know, the kids who were locked out of school, maybe that was just a mistake because the long-term effects of that, as you say, you know, are hard to measure. But the company you might end up keeping by articulating that view, if you're generally sane and rational about a lot of other stuff in terms of whether or not vaccines, you know, are a lie and 5G masks gave you COVID, you'd just rather just say nothing because you don't want to have a big hostage argument to... I think that happens in lots of these issues, unfortunately. It means the middle area gets completely depopulated of voices.
I think that's exactly it. I think that is a massive problem. I also think no one wants to write kind of normie takes, right? Everybody wants to stake out their kind of interesting or contrarian or provocative position. And writing a piece that says vaccines work and basically everyone in Britain loved them and would have more if they could.
Turns out they taste delicious too, you know.
Right? It's just like, but no one... But that's the, that is the story of vaccines in Britain. Like I was reading now, you know, the fact that they're not going to offer them, you know, they're only going to offer them to the elderly and vulnerable now. People are like quite grumpy about that. Like you hear all constantly about all these Americans who think it's a terrible imposition and what about my body, my choice? And you don't really hear a lot about all the British people who are gagging for more vaccines. They want to be vaccinated up the wazoo.
And that comes back to that, I think that misreading again of the extent to which British political culture is like, and isn't like the American one. I mean, there was so many Tory people who were in government in early 2020 have said to me, I think a lot of them have gone on record now saying it, that they couldn't believe like how well-behaved people were in lockdown. Because Boris Johnson is a sort of libertarian slash libertine, likes the idea of breaking rules. He just thought it was so obvious that Merry England would never tolerate the pubs being shuttered and he couldn't possibly be the man who did that. And it turned out that they had the opposite problem. They were people were like locking themselves down too diligently. They just, and then it was just...
Yeah, and we discovered that Britain was actually a sort of deeply authoritarian place. And the sheer lure of authoritarianism, which is that like it just relieves you of a huge cognitive burden because you just get told what to do and then you just have to do it. And like, you might not be happy about it, but like you aren't riven by existential angst. I think I really kind of saw that in those months. And like, I felt it too. And this is what I mean. I come back to the people who are now very upset about it and trying to preach the kind of lockdown regret. I think a lot of them felt scared and wanted to be told what to do. And now they feel that they've humbled themselves in some way.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, there's a sense that you just feel a bit... Yeah, you gave up too much of yourself in some way and then...
Emasculated, like that you bent the knee. You're not sheeple, you know, you're a proud individualist. And yet, actually, where were all those proud individualists at the end of March 2020?
What was it Marcus Fish said? You know, we're not a papers police society. This is the stuff of Nazi Germany or equivalent type sort of ludicrous hyperbole.
It's been a real banner year for comparing things to Nazi Germany, hasn't it?
If in doubt, probably the Third Reich, probably on the slippery slope. I think we know where all slippery slopes slide to in the end.
They all end in a tiny toothbrush moustache. Yeah, it's true.
But you know, the idea that this was incredibly draconian and an affront to decent constitutional rule and done in an incredibly slapdash way, that was actually true. I mean, yeah,
no, that's the thing. I think
the most
right?
extraordinary law was passed very quickly with no scrutiny that essentially had all the theoretical apparatus not of an authoritarian, of a of a mad ultra totalitarian state. And I can't make up my mind whether it's brilliant that it just happened and they just lifted it again because, like, well, we don't need that anymore. And no one thought, well, let's keep this and then we can have a totalitarian state and rule forever. Yeah, so hooray Britain for just not being the country that did that. And also, well, that's a bit frightening that they did that and actually only the mad people complained about it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I but again, it comes back to that. Do you want to write the piece that puts you on the wrong side of your, you know, your in-group? Because the thing I think there is not enough reporting on is the fact that even now, and I think, what's his name, Tristan, the Evening Standard's courts reporter, is still diligently working them because of the backlog in magistrates' courts is ludicrous. There are still COVID prosecutions working their way through the system. And people who are, like, you know, homeless or had mental health problems or alcohol problems or whatever it might be, did less than Boris Johnson did and are getting punished with, you know, things that are kind of escalating.
Yeah, surely you need an amnesty for that stuff now, don't you? Well, how is that not a thing?
How has that not happened and how is no one agitating for it? And, like, it's one of those things that annoys me because a truly kind
of... Well, we're two journalists. I feel we all... Why isn't someone else agitating for this? I'm now agitating on this podcast. That's going to be the first campaign of the Politics on the Couch podcast. Gets me.
Okay, that should be a postcard because madly banging people up for very minor COVID infractions, that was... and is appalling. And it was really, you know, classist, all of that stuff, right? It was really, it was so much easier to do lockdown in your lovely big leafy home with a garden and a spare bedroom than it was for, like, you know, 19-year-olds in university halls or whatever it might be. Or
what was the great line that someone used that said, yeah, lockdown was essentially middle-class people hiding while working-class people brought them stuff. Yeah, pretty efficient description of, in lots of cases, what happened.
Sort of true, but the only consolation, I guess, being that it did drive quite a lot of those middle-class people bonkers, as far as I can see, both in the sense of falling down conspiracy rabbit holes and also in the sense of encouraging their weird anxiety disorders to persist for a long time. Whereas if you were like a postman or a delivery driver, then you sort of had to kind of just learn to live with it, right? Rather than, I see this more in America, that there were people who were just like still now double masking and stuff like that. And you think, whereas I think, again...
That's because it became a badge of culture war identity. I mean, here it was astonishingly...
Yeah, and it didn't happen here in the same way.
I mean, it became political towards the end and it became politicised because of Johnson and Partygate. But actually... I remember talking to pollsters at the time saying, look, the reason Keir Starmer's getting no purchase on this and this is just absolute death valley for him politically in every respect is because most people just see this as a big storm that's blown in and it's not a political event. And no amount of the left and Labour sort of saying Boris Johnson's awful, he's terrible, he's getting this all wrong, is going to change anyone's minds about that. It only changed after Barnard Castle. That was the point at which it flipped.
But also, to the credit of the Conservative Party, they did treat it in a much more grown-up fashion than the American right from the start and still to this day, right? The Andrew Bridgen kind of tendency has been ruthlessly marginalised in a way that just simply hasn't happened in other places.
Yeah, hooray for us. We're only slightly bogged.
I know, no, but I always like to end every podcast by praising the Tory party. Just, you know, thank you to them for everything they've done for us. You know, it's a great bunch of lads.
Vaccine rollout. Hooray. Well, let's have another 12 years, another 13 years.
No, but there was, ministers wearing masks and stuff like that, right? Which a lots of, you know, was seen as being quite humbling and stuff like that. I'm just, the Atlantic's just run a really brilliant profile of Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is like Arnold Schwarzenegger's final act. And I think one of the best things that he did during the lockdowns was he narrated, again, like using the language that people spoke to people on the right about strength, you know, like he had a whole thing that was like wearing masks, like, you know, we fought the Second World War and put up with, you know, privation for 4 years and you can't even just put something over your nose and mouth, like, grow up, you're a man, like a man takes one for the team. And flipping that rhetoric round, I thought, was really incredibly effective. So, you know, and that is definitely less of an issue here than it was over there, right? That it was something humbling about wearing a mask or getting the vaccine or whatever it might be.
I'm trying to now think when and if it really caught on as a culture war emblem at all. And
I don't think it did, because I think actually, to credit to the left here, that once everyone got the vaccine, everyone was a bit like, well, we can probably stop with the masks now, can't we? Like, we've done that. But that, which I think was a totally normal thing to do. Like, if you had to pick, what you would want is 75% of your population vaccinated and not wearing masks anymore, rather than a much lower percentage, but then some people vaccinated, but then some people wearing like 15 masks.
Well, this comes back to, we should probably stop on this point because it's getting late. If you want to be optimistic, again, in terms of thinking maybe we don't have to be completely polarized and we're not vulnerable to endless sort of self-destruction by culture wars, and we're not living in a post-truth bog of relativity and relativism that means that there is no fact that can be commonly agreed. I mean, the single biggest thing that happened between 2020 and 2023 was ultimately a story of science very quickly investigating a problem, coming up with a really good solution, delivering a vaccine. Unbelievable. Like, so what do you think about, like, the Black Death or whatever? You know, it was basically people running around, sort of flagellants, you know, marching from town to town, you know, penitently praying for salvation while actually spreading the disease of 600 years before they were going to get the antibiotics. We had, what, 9 months between someone saying, well, this is a bit nasty, and here's a vaccine. And that's amazing. And people took it and it worked. And it was like, that's a story of progress and
I know
truth, actual scientific truth, demonstrable facts, totally winning out over bad things and superstition. So that's hooray.
I know. And I think it's a shame that the Tory party have stopped telling that story, because it was a deeply patriotic and kind of compelling story. I know exactly what you mean. My parents were both 74 when the pandemic came out, and my mum had just recovered from pleurisy. And I thought, there is no way they're making it out the other side of this. And yet there they are, still going to the garden centre now, so both 77. And I've had, you know, at least another extra 3 years with them. And I, you know, and they were first in the queue for the vaccine. They couldn't have, they were very proud of having got the AstraZeneca one. We want the British one, they said. But like, that was kind of...
What a Morris Minor of vaccines. That guy felt rough after that one. I was very glad to get a bit of a good solid Pfizer. Tasted much better in my arm, tell you that much.
Well, there was unfortunately a split in this household, because Jonathan was so old that he got the AstraZeneca, whereas some of us who were extremely youthful were Pfizered from the start. So yeah, now I got the proper Grey Goose, you know, like chilled shot from the start, and he got the kind of workmanlike beer draft.
And science rules, and actually facts are a thing, even if people talk about post-truth politics and in a polarized world, actually there is a solid ground of evidence and reality that everyone can climb aboard. And there's probably more of us who want to be there than the mad, angry internet people like to pretend. I believe that.
It's rousing. I like that. That was almost as rousing as that bit you did on the Daily Politics, which was very rousing.
That was quite rousing. Although that was very partisan. That was the opposite. That was, you know, except, well, I like to think it was true, but that was a rant.
No, I thought it was objective because I agreed with it.
Well, quite. And for more on brilliant insights and all the things we've been talking about, buy my book and also Ellen's book.
Buy Raph's book first. And then if you're just flush with cash, then maybe also buy Difficult Women.
How do we promote your output? The Atlantic, you write for The Atlantic. You have a Substack where you do all these things.
I do. I don't tweet anymore though, Raph. I've given it up.
Have you really though?
I'm clean since the whole of 2023.
Oh, really?
I did one tweet. I've decided not to be like...
Clean but apart from the one. Yeah, we've all done that. It was just one in the pub, you know.
I just had one tote when I didn't inhale. No, I had to reply to someone because I wanted them to just be a source for a story. And I was like, hi, this is interesting. Can you contact me? And then now I've since deleted that. But no, I have not had any spicy opinions on Twitter. And let me tell you, it feels good. I've become the kind of unbearable ex-alcoholic who now texts other people when I see them getting into fights on Twitter. It's like, have you considered not getting into fights on Twitter? It actually feels really amazing when you don't. Yeah, you've just got, like, your skin is so much clearer. You've got so much more time.
Yeah, you're the person who goes, oh, yeah, I now can't stand the smell of smoke. Oh, it makes me feel sick just thinking about it. Yeah. Yeah, you're one of those
people. Smell of internet arguments repulses me. Yeah. But I put my spicy opinions on Substack and WhatsApp groups. I put my spicy opinions in various WhatsApp groups. No, it's not reading books or anything like that. TikTok actually has been brilliant because I just consume that.
That sounds like you're just saying, I'm so glad I gave up heroin. I'm just because crack actually is, to tell you what, that stuff
really takes the edge off. It's very Moorish. Yeah.
Right. That's enough drugs metaphors and self-promotion. Let's upload these files. Stay on the line, Helen. And thank you very much for coming on our podcast.
That's all right.
Like, you sound a bit more enthusiastic. That's all right. Yeah, I'll go if I must. You sound a bit more enthusiastic about it.
Okay, let me give you a flawless. Okay, do it again. I'm ready.
And so thanks, Helen, for coming on the podcast again.
Thank you for having me on. Yeah, that was great. Didn't even sound perfect. Sarcastic. Yeah. It was just
no,
beautiful.
Not at all.
Yeah, thanks.
Didn't even look sarcastic.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Politics on the Couch. Hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to read some of Helen Lewis's work, a good starting point is to go to her Substack page, which is called The Blue Stocking. For an elderly Generation Xer like myself, it's the only way I can stay in touch with what millennials or Generation whatever else they're called, Generation Zers, are up to. So go check that out. There's also a Radio 4 program on at the moment called The Spark, which she hosts and conducts some really interesting long-form interviews with people who've got sparks of ideas that are worth listening to. And also, The Atlantic has just released one of Helen's long reads all about the state of the American state of Florida, looking at the culture, politics, etc., etc. There you go. We'll put some links in the show notes. And oh, I almost forgot. I don't know if you know, but Raph's got a book out too, which you can pre-order at his website, raphaelbear.com. That's about it for this week. Thanks so much indeed for listening. Until next time, bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.